Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I had an interesting tweet this week from someone who was mentioning it was Diwali, and that was really hard for her because it's celebration and time. So thinking of you if Diwali is a difficult time for you, if people are not around with you at this time of year. And also just if it's cold and dark and it's getting to you, I hope you're doing okay. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for the lovely comments about our episode last week with Fee Glover, which was our 100th episode. Incredible, can't believe. Amazing. Just thank you for staying with us this long and listening. And it was a really wonderful episode. So if you haven't listened, I recommend that you do. And if you did enjoy it, please, as ever, rate, review and subscribe. It really does genuinely help other griefsters find the podcast. This week, I'm talking to writer Richard Beard. Richard has written a lot of books, as you'll hear, fiction and non-fiction. The one we particularly focus on is a book called The Day They Went Missing, which is about his own investigation into the death of his brother when they were children. It's a book that was actually recommended to me quite a few times by other griefsters, and I was always a bit apprehensive about it because it always looked really sad. But as you'll hear in this conversation, I have read it, and it's such a good book. And especially if you're in the club of the death happened a long time ago and the memories are slipping, I really would recommend it because it really is just basically about memory and grief. Richard came in to talk to me about his brother Nicky, who died when they were children. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer Richard Beard, who is the author of The Day That Went Missing and other books, I should say.
Oh, but, yeah, sorry, it's my turn.
Yes, exactly.
No, I was just waiting for a fulsome introduction there.
That's it, mate. That's it. That's what we're getting.
Yes, 10 books. It's my 10th book, and wow. I'm about to finish my 11th book.
My goodness. How many do you, like, what's your schedule like? Do you do one a year?
No, it's taken quite a long time.
Yeah.
And they are a mix of novels and non-fiction books.
Oh, wow.
So The Day That Went Missing was the fourth non-fiction, and there are 6 novels. The new one is going to be another novel.
Oh, wow. Do you ever sort of think, oh, next one's going to be non-fiction, or do you just think, oh, that's the idea I want to write about?
Well, sometimes they arrive, non-fiction. Yeah. Ideas, things which just demand to be written about. But usually it's just after the exhaustion of a novel. non-fiction is a lot easier.
Oh, yeah.
I think the process is easier. It doesn't mean that emotionally or psychologically it's easier, but the process is a lot easier because you can talk to people and people tell you brilliant stories. And that's a lot easier than sitting on your own at your desk just trying to make it all up from scratch.
Yeah, but then it's hard to write truth, isn't it?
In non-fiction?
Like in non-fiction when you're just sitting like, oh yeah, I'm only saying because I'm writing saying non-fiction at the moment, and I find like I'd rather be with the characters that anything can happen rather than being like, oh, I have to sort of say what actually happened. Do you find that?
Yeah, I think there's always an element of selection in nonfiction, and that's why this term creative nonfiction has become, you know, a very good description, I think, of what a lot of memoir is in particular, because you're selecting the best bits, if you like, the bits which have the most impact, but they're all true. Yeah. It's just knowing which bits to leave out, really. But again, I think it's easier to decide what to leave out rather than start with absolutely nothing and sort of build up a character. Though there is a great freedom, as you say, in fiction that I can decide that someone doesn't die. I mean, that's the great freedom of fiction. In non-fiction, it's not there.
You're like, and they all live and it's fine. But obviously that you end the story quite quickly when that happens.
Yeah, but the other thing about fiction is there's a great mystery to it. You're not quite sure where it's going to go when you start, and you can end up being much more lethal than you thought you were going to be at the beginning. And you do have a tragic mindset at that particular time in your life, which comes out in the writing, and yet you still go about your daily business and are smiley and generally try to be nice to people. But when you're back at your desk, everyone's in some kind of tragic, chaotic state. And that's the mystery of writing. That's one of the things which is addictive about it, is you find out things about yourself as you go through it.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, that I don't even dare compare what I do to what you do, because I feel like you do proper writing. But when I used to write Edinburgh shows, and then I would look back at the Edinburgh show and everybody's dad was dead in the Edinburgh show, like all the characters, and I hadn't quite noticed, like, or their dad was missing or they couldn't find it. Like, it was always looming over one of the characters. And it's something, like you said, it's the mystery of writing. You're like, oh, I see.
Yeah, but one of the things you have to be sure of is that that is actually what you want to write about, and it's not just something you've taken off the peg, that you've seen lots of other stories with a dead dad. And think, well, that's good. I mean, the classic example is the young adult books, where first rule of that is that the parents have to be got out of the way. They have to either be away or in prison or dead, and very often they're dead.
Harry Potter.
And then that can come back, it seems to me, in midlife crisis fiction, is that you have the same liberty. The parents tend to die, and therefore middle-aged people have the same freedom as young adult characters. They can go and have adventures.
Yeah. The Day That Went Missing is a brilliant book. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I have to say, I did not want to read it. I hope that's all right to say. I felt like, because I get so many books about death, and when I just read the description, I was like, oh God, oh, I can't cope with this one. Sorry, I'm being mega honest with you. But funny enough, as we were just talking before we started recording, several griefsters, as we call the people who listen to the show, were like, you have to read The Day That Went Missing, Carrie Ad. It's so good. It's so good. And I think I was afraid of it. I was just really afraid of it. And obviously having a child, I'm happy to read about people's parents dying, but I find anything young children, I find a bit like, I'm worried I'm going to get overwhelmed. I am so glad I picked it up and didn't do the thing that people do to me with this podcast, where they go, oh, I don't want to listen to it. I'm a bit like funny about death. And I think, fuck you. Fuck you, people die. Why aren't you listening to it? Which is probably what you were thinking when I was saying that. And I just thought it was an absolutely incredible book. So we should start, I guess, by saying, who are we remembering today? So who is, and who does the book remember, as yes, in a way?
Well, I think when you're, it's a death that takes place in my childhood, when I was 11 and my brother was 9, and he drowned in the sea and I was in the water with him.
And his name was?
His name was Nicky.
Nicky.
Which was not a name that we said in our family then for nearly 40 years until I started writing the book.
Wow.
That he wasn't part of our life. We didn't commemorate him in any way. I'm remembering him, and in a way I'm trying to bring him back to life by writing about him. And because we had been in a state of denial, I just had to find some kind of relics of his life, anything which reminded us or could remind us of him, because he'd been wiped out, he'd been deleted, and I could only put him back together by finding the remnants that were left behind, odd bits and pieces in the attic, some photos, old school magazines, letters, anything I could get my hands on, which turned out to not be very much. But I think when you're remembering any type of grief, and really whenever it happens, you are also remembering the person you were when it happened. Mm. So I'm also remembering myself and the kind of person I was. And I think I'm trying to recapture something of what I was before this major event intervened in my life, really, and just trying to see if there's something of that person that I can get back at the same time as I'm trying to get Nicky back. So it's not just about getting him back. It's about getting something back of perhaps of the innocence of myself, or the kind of essence of whatever I was before this event came to really determine the way that I see life, which is life is something which is kind of beautiful and precious, but it's always open to being interrupted suddenly without warning. That can make anyone who's experienced that kind of very sudden trauma very cautious, I think, because you think, well, you know, an airplane can fall out of the sky at any time on my head, and therefore I must be careful. And that then limits the ways in which you can live.
I mean, that's totally how I dealt with it. It's funny because my dad died when I was 15, and not everybody deals with it in that cautious way. I think it's really interesting that you say that, because that's definitely it made me feel like, oh, okay, anyone can die at any moment, nothing's safe, keep your eyes open. Like, lesson learned.
Yeah, okay, I mean, that's our non-fiction response.
Yeah.
But I can see if you're writing a novel, you might say, well, fiction, I've got this character, encounters sudden death, and now he's actually completely, or she is completely liberated
here
and can go and do whatever they want to do, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they die, because it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could react in a different way.
I mean,
but
I've
that's the way we react.
And I've met people who have, absolutely, and you know, who've been like, oh, I just went crazy. And I always think, oh, wow, what must it have been like to go crazy? So I always find it interesting when equally people are like, oh, yeah, I got really cautious. I guess we should set, like, just because if people haven't read the book. So you were on holiday with the family, and there were four boys. Yeah. And then, well, do you want to tell what happened? Is that
okay? Yeah, so I'll start where I started when I thought this is a book that I want to write. This is a story that I wanted to tell. All I knew for myself was, so there were four of us in the family. I'm the second. So Nicky is 9, I'm 11. We're on holiday, and this is all I kind of remembered at the time. We go on holiday to Cornwall. Nicky and I go away from the main family group. We go swimming in this cove, and we get into trouble, and he dies. And I had a very clear memory of the actual last moments in the water, which I spent a lot of time trying to get rid of and have never managed to do it. But apart from that, the way that my brain had processed this, along with the complicity of the rest of the family, was just to go into complete denial about Nicky's existence really very quickly. So all I knew was, I've got this memory of being in the sea with my brother and this vision of him drowning. With the two of us in the water, and my own utterly panicked, kind of scrambled escape from the situation, and the very strong sense of survival, which I've never had since, fortunately, in this sense where it's absolutely paramount just to live, which is a surge of energy and a surge of absolute kind of intense meaning, that this is the only meaning in this situation. So I had that as a core memory. And then apart from that, I didn't know whether Nicky's body had ever been found. I didn't know the date when it happened.
Yeah,
I didn't know the month when it happened. I didn't know where it was. And I was in my kind of mid-40s when I started thinking, this is ridiculous. I know nothing about him. All I know is that there are kind of 10 or 11 photos of which I'm aware of his existence. And his old cricket bat is in a bucket in my mum's shed. And that's about all I know. And I thought, well, I can start off by finding out the date. And it turned out to be harder to even find out the date because I only found it out eventually by having to sit down with my mum and just ask her directly. And it turned out she was very happy to talk about it. She'd been wanting to talk about it all those years, but because we'd got into this pattern of repression and this pattern of deleting Nicky from our lives, I had never before sat down with her and said, Mum, just tell me something about him. And therefore, then I gradually got the facts back, and I it was like an investigation. I got together everything I could which said something about him, and I found out more about the day. And that's why it's called The Day That Went Missing, that it was an utterly missing day, and he was a missing person. And then that's what the book is. It's about my attempt to rediscover him, to discover what had actually happened on the day. And why it had happened, and why we'd blocked it out, really. Why was this so extreme? I mean, we never celebrated his birthday. There was never anything on the day of his death. I couldn't remember his birthday.
Do you remember him disappearing? As in, like, do you remember the next year being like, oh, no one said Nicky? Or did it just slowly happen? I mean, in the book you say you're all at boarding school, aren't you? So there's that kind of ease of you're away from your parents, I guess, so that you're not you know, is perhaps you're not there for with them when those anniversaries. Do you remember that, like being, I guess, being 12 and 13 and being like, oh, it's his birthday, no one said anything? Or does it, is it all blanked now?
No, well, I don't remember any detail like that. Wow. I think there was a strong sense of, because of the if you like, the real drive for this came from my dad, of the drive of the repression. He was the one who's really pushing down. Is that I think by not mentioning Nicky and not thinking about him, I mean, I can't speak for my brothers, but I certainly felt I was pleasing them. I was making them happy. That's what they wanted to happen. And now sometimes my mum would mention his name, but when she mentioned his name, it was almost like a kind of taunt to my dad. It was like a kind of... Wow. But I mean, when I say sometimes, I mean, I can probably think of four occasions in all those years. She would just say his name as if, you know, we could maybe, you know, someone could say something now. And there was the depth of the silence which followed the mention of his name was black. And... it was an utter abyss of silence.
And your dad never spoke about him?
Well, my mum told me, because he died in 2011, so I didn't start the book until after he died, and I think that's partly why I started. I couldn't have even had the concept of doing this while he was alive. So that was a liberation through death, if you like. I said, his death allowed me to explore my brother's death earlier. But my mum told me that they had never talked about it, just the two of them, which I was astonished by. But there were details which came out when I was researching the book that we'd had, me and my brothers, completely blanked out, which turns out, I think, were probably very significant, is that we were on holiday, and it was a 4-week holiday because my dad had cancer at the time, which again I blocked out. I knew he had cancer because the back of his neck was carved out for most of his adult life. But I didn't know it was at that time. So therefore it was a longer holiday in which my mum was going to be with the children, to sort of, they could practice living without him. He'd just come down for 2 weeks, and the other 2 weeks could have practice, preparing for his death. So it was a very stressful time for them. So that was one thing which I didn't know about. But the other thing was that after Nicky died, so that was at the end of the second week, we went back up to Swindon, where he come from. So driving up from Cornwall to Swindon via Exeter services. I remember the meal in the Exeter services, the fish and chips. It was a treat. And of course, a desperately sad treat. We didn't really want fish and chips. I think, you know, children know. We knew at the time, my mum and dad were trying so hard
to make it okay.
But fish and chips isn't going to make it okay 2 days after your brother has died.
Nothing makes it okay.
And so then there's a funeral on the Thursday of the next week. And then... this was the thing that my brothers and I had blocked out, is we went back down to the holiday house, and not just back down to the holiday house, we went back to the beach to finish the holiday, finish the last week of the holiday.
I found that, when I read that in the book, I found that extraordinary. I mean, I think sometimes, especially, maybe this is silly, but like the end of the 20th century and the generational, I can see why your parents made that choice and kind of that different, but I can also, I can't imagine making that choice, because it just seems like such a generational shift, you know what I mean, of that generation being like, well, we booked the holiday, we're going back. Like, emotionally, I can't imagine being in that place, but I think that's my privilege of growing up in a much later time where emotions are allowed to be experienced.
Well, I think there has been a change in the way that openness is more valued, and there's a vocabulary as well for grief, which I don't think existed. But I wrote in the book that I feel exactly the same way. And I think they must have been temporarily deranged by grief.
They probably absolutely were. Their son had just died. Like, there is a madness, you know, so...
But I do understand it at the same time, in the sense that, I mean, I think it's important to say, I think they were doing their best.
They thought
this was the best thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't deranged in the sense of, you know, running around like headless chickens and just the first thing that comes to hand. I think that the way they thought it was best was, they personally were probably upset by the by everyone trying to help them. And in a very English way, they just wanted to get away from people showing them sympathy.
And being vulnerable, I guess, because you're vulnerable when everyone's offering you help.
Yeah, and you feel weak, and you feel you don't want that to happen in the first place. You don't want the situation to have happened, and you want to just get somewhere else where it's as if it hasn't happened. Yeah. And then there was the idea of getting back on the horse, I think, is that it's more than a stiff upper lip. It's quite a sort of brutal sense of self-reliance. You've got to go back to the beach, you've got to essentially just carry on as normal, which means as if nothing had happened. And that's in fact what the book says, and what this grief cast is about, is that pretending nothing has happened that is the real derangement, because something has happened. In fact, the biggest thing that happens in life has happened. And that's why it's worth talking about it in situations like this.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because especially we talk in terms of narrative. Like, for that narrative, I guess, for your dad, for everything to be okay, Nikki had to not exist. Like, because otherwise, you, like you said, to acknowledge, if you acknowledge, oh, he's died, you can't carry on. Because, of course, is that a fair thing to say? Like, in terms of, I'm just talking about narrative here in your family, so maybe that's not very fair.
Well, I think it's that it's not, you're trying to carry on as normal,
yeah.
But it's not normal.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
There's a person missing.
Yeah.
There's one person missing.
And that's, so, I mean, the only way you can do that is if it's like, well, just block them out, they're not there.
Well, you can't do it. So yeah. The only way to do it is by faking it. You're just faking normal. Mm. So from that point in your life, and we were talking earlier about how you deal with things, whether you become cautious or whether you throw all caution to the wind. But this is a way of living which then is not helpful for lots of different reasons. It's essentially something right in the centre of your life. You just fake it. Okay, there was a boy, there's no longer a boy. We're just going to fake it. We're just going to pretend that boy was never there. So the idea of pretense and performing becomes part of your life as well. And that's at an age before you even really know what you're doing. And you end up being 18, 19, 20. And that's just a way of life.
Mm.
So how do you make things seem normal? You pretend. So there is no normal. So you lose all orientation in life, any sense of genuine orientation in reality.
I mean, like you said, and no disrespect to your parents at all. Like, obviously, they thought they were just doing the best in horrific circumstances. And how can I always think that in this show? Like, you can't judge, because people judge me for choices I made after my dad died. And I was like, my dad's just died. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, the biggest thing that's ever happened is happening. When did you sort of notice that fakery? Like, did you sort of get, like, was it in your 20s? Did you think, oh, this isn't okay? Or did you carry right on through? Because I found, like, it took me to, I sort of hit about 30 that I was like, oh, I haven't really dealt with something, have I? These things are not okay. But my 20s, I was able to kind of be like, yeah, it's fine, my dad died, no big deal. You know, these things happen. Like, I don't want to talk about it, basically.
So that meant you didn't want to talk about it, it's just you weren't ready to talk about it in that period.
I think I wasn't ready. And I think, you know, obviously there's a lot of discussion and grief bereavement with children. And I think they say, the things I've read, that like pre-10, it's like very hard for a child to get the vocabulary. And then sort of like, that's the problem. The 10 to like 19 is quite tricky, because you sort of know, but you sort of don't know. And like, you understand what it means to be dead, but you don't have the words for it. So yeah, I think for a long time I was frozen in not having any vocabulary for it. So I think I just didn't know how to really say, oh, I have this pain and it's so painful and it hasn't gone and it really still hurts. Because I think that felt like not enough. I was just like, ow. Ow. So I didn't know how to begin talking about it, really.
Yeah, one thing which always sticks in my mind, which again, this was sort of during the period of denial, but I remember it for a reason, was a friend of my parents, their daughter died when she was in her mid-20s,
right.
And it was a kind of an adult
cot
death thing. It was sort of very sudden and unexpected. And I happened to be at my parents' house, and I was the same kind of age as her, so I'd been in my mid-20s, and I picked up the phone, and it was him, and it was something to do with funeral arrangements. And so I asked him how he was. And he said, so the father of this girl who had just died said, in some ways in a very English way, because it was measured, but he said, well, of course, we're very miserable. And I thought, well, that's, in a way, it sounds a strange thing to say, and a kind of English thing to say. But I thought that, well, that's fantastic. He's admitted that he's miserable. And I think, well, in our family, we never even admitted we were miserable. And it's really stuck with me. I really admired his honesty to be able to say that, because I was expecting him to say, oh, you know.
These things happen.
Exactly.
Carry on. Yeah.
We'll be, you know, give it 6 months, you know. And just to hear an adult say, you know, while we're very miserable, really struck me.
Yeah.
And that shows how far we'd gone the other way.
Yeah.
And the other thing, which I think it is, which I now have very strong feelings on about, is children and funerals. I think children should go to funerals.
And you didn't go to?
No, so we didn't go to my own brother's funeral.
Yeah.
And my mum and some other people who were there told me the story of the funeral, where emotion was shown, where adults did cry. But one of the problems of, I think, children not going to the funeral is that we never saw adults cry.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, we need to deal with it like them. They're not sad. They're not crying. So we need to make a special effort not to cry. Whereas I think it's would have been incredibly helpful to go to the funeral, see adults showing emotion, and therefore that shows that the emotion is allowed. We are allowed to feel sad because they're sad. Whereas we got the brave face. When people put on a brave face, the children get the brave face the whole time. And then you just think, well, that's how I should react. And therefore you hold everything in. And
I think it's so massively underestimated how much children do what they see, not do what they're told. Like you can be told, oh, you know, you can talk or we're here. But like, unless someone's doing it, you know, you're like, well, how do I do it? Like you said, the vocabulary isn't there. I did an event with Marie Curie recently about grief, because that's what I do. And there was a lady who deals with children who are bereaved. And she said exactly the same thing, that a lot of adults don't want to get upset. And then the way she counsels them is to say, like, you know, when you have a cold, you're always saying, you know, you take paracetamol, you take cough medicine. And she's like, it makes you feel better. And she's like, the tears will make you feel better. So that's what you know, we know that. We know chemically crying makes you feel better, you get it out, all of these things. So she was like, if the adults can start thinking of the tears as medicine, and then you can explain to the children, like, oh, crying is good for you, it's okay. But she encounters these adults who are like, oh, my child's not okay, but I'm equally not crying. And yeah, she said the same thing, like, if they don't see you dealing with it in that way, how do you know how to? I think that's fascinating that miserable was to you, that guy just saying that was like, wow. Like,
yeah, I thought, how honest.
Yeah, he's really gone there. Yeah. So I thought it was interesting as well, and said in the book that you, and what we were sort of talking about before, you were writing stories of deaths and drowning, but in your fiction. Were you aware of that? Like when you started writing these other stories, you talk about that book. I can't remember the name of it. The other one you wrote, where there's two brothers and one of them, you sort of rewrote it.
Yeah, I had written it. Well, I had written this memory of the actual drowning, of being in the water with Nicky when he drowned, was something that I came to the point where I wanted to write it. And I was writing a novel. It's called Lazarus is Dead, and Lazarus is the only named friend of Jesus in the Bible. So he has follows his disciples and his family, but Lazarus is the only named friend. So the premise of the book is that Jesus and Lazarus are friends. Lazarus has a young brother who drowns with Lazarus. The two of them are in the water, and Jesus just stands on the shore and doesn't do anything. It's a kind of central scene in the book. And I effectively just wrote my memory.
Yeah.
And it reads very similarly to how I wrote it in the memoir. And one of the reasons I did that was, well, I found it was something powerful in me that wanted to come out. I'm a writer, therefore I eventually got to writing it down. But that was in my eighth book. It had taken that long to get there. And I thought, well, my family are going to read this.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have to start talking about that. I think that was an unconscious motivation for doing it.
Let's do it.
So, of course, the book came out. And what I discovered is not all my family read my books.
Yeah, welcome to the world of creative. People do not indulge in your work as much as you think they might.
I thought I was going to get the phone call going, oh, at last, you've talked about that. But in fact, I was playing a trick on myself, because I was in the water with Nicky. My brothers weren't in the water. My mum wasn't there.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what had happened. But it turned out, when I came back to the memoir and I said to them, like, I've already written about this, didn't you kind of notice? Is that in the intervening years, because then it had been over 30 years since Nicky had died, they had created their own memories, which had nothing to do with me. But my mum couldn't remember. She remembered her other children were safe and Nicky went in the water and he drowned. My younger brother had a memory of being told that Nicky had been swept away by a rogue wave, didn't even know he was in the water swimming.
Wow.
Tim couldn't remember that we were together. So everyone, it was like our memories were like creatures which had evolved in different ways because they'd had no connection. And this is another reason to talk about grief, is because then you can kind of agree and therefore keep a memory, as opposed to really we'd veered a long way away from each other. And I was the only person who knew because I was actually there. So they didn't even know I was in the water. They didn't know I'd had this experience. And therefore I realised, well, they don't know that over all these years that have passed, that this is something that's been in my head. So if there was some kind of secret hidden resentment in me, is why does nobody come and say, poor you, because you had to see your own brother die? Actually, they don't know. I mean, it kind of absolved them from I think I probably did have some secret resentment in me that nobody had even bothered to, you know, pat me on the shoulder for 30 years. But they didn't know. They'd been dealing with it in their own way, coping it with it in their own way. And one way you can do that, if everyone is silent about a death, is you make up new memories.
Yeah.
And they evolve like creatures, and they become something completely different from what from where they started.
And I think that's what I meant at the beginning when I very badly said I didn't want to read the book, is I thought, oh, it's just going to be the telling of this. It's just going to be like, we go to the water, this happens. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I can walk with him through this story. But actually, what amazed me about the book was that it's about memory. The whole thing is about memory. And I guess why I'm super drawn to that is that, as I am 20 years ago, and my memories fade and are really hard to grasp, like, and a lot of people I speak to on the show tend to be what I call more fresh out the box. So it's like 2 or 3 years, they're adults, and their memories, I get jealous. I think, oh, they're so stable. They're like, my dad said this, we were in this hospital. Whereas I'm like, I say things on the show, my mum then texts me the next week, like, that didn't happen. Like, that, he wasn't in a hospice, he was in a hospital. I'm like, because, especially as a kid, you know, you already, everything's already a bit blurry. You don't really know how you got somewhere. You just in a car, get put in a car and you turn up. So I think the book deals with that really well. And I found the bit where your mum said, because you have a conversation with her, don't you, and she says, no, like, you were next to me, like, she thought you were there, and you were in, you in reality you were in the water with Nikki. Like, I found that amazing how you said people's memories just
that's
do what they want,
yeah,
to do.
And that's how she coped with it, by, yeah, in her memory she had her three of the safe boys were safe on the sand, yeah, with her having the picnic, whereas the unsafe boy had gone off and had drowned.
Yeah.
And clearly that was a way of coping. It was
of
a way
course,
of saying, well,
yeah,
because she could have lost two sons on,
oh,
on the same
God,
day,
yeah,
and that must have been an unbearable thought to her as well.
Oh, yeah, there's so much for your mum to take in and to deal with. It's just, and I don't blame her for that memory at all. Like, I completely understood why you would protect yourself like that. But I found it, I guess it's, this maybe sounds a bit cold, but it's an interesting experiment to read your book, because there were so separate memories, because I guess and a different family might have talked and arranged the memories in a different, gone, oh no, that's what happened. But because you said they had become so separate, the four of you, they had completely, like, the fact that you said you're the younger brother, who's obviously much younger and even less equipped to deal with quite what happened that day, had made up this sort of dramatic story that, you know, almost has a, yeah, it feels like a story that he's been told, and his brain twisted it, doesn't it, rather than like a reality to it.
Yeah, and it's amazing how durable those kind of false memories can,
yeah,
be as well. Because,
yeah,
when I sat down with each of my, well, two of my brothers and with my mum, and those, they're not, they're, I suppose they were interviews, if you like. I interviewed,
yeah,
my own,
yeah,
family, which is a very strange thing to do. I said to him, well, you know, do you know anyone else who's been swept away by a wave? When you go on a holiday to the seaside with your kids, are you worried that they'll just,
yeah,
walk along and a wave will come and sweep them away? I know it can happen to fishermen if they're,
yeah,
out on,
yeah,
rocks, and it can happen, but it's not something we tend to worry about when you're just walking along the seashore.
Yeah.
And he had never really thought about it in those terms. And that's, we hold on to,
yeah,
memories that protect us.
I also love that interrogation is only the way a big brother could interrogate a little brother. Like, the way you interrogate was like, I mean, really? Like, that's what you thought happened. Which also made me laugh in the book. The way the brothers interact with each other was, yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, but that was one of the if you like, I mean, yeah, it's a joy. I'm going to say the word joy,
yeah,
of,
yeah,
the book, is that in recovering Nikki, I realised that we'd had this idealised, part of my view of him was that he was kind of, not that he was idealised, but, and this connects to what I kind of stopped before when I was thinking about this in terms of my mum remembering her three boys safe and then Nikki going off to drown.
Mm.
But that's because he took on the role of the dead brother. That's,
yeah,
what he was. And unfortunately, after he died, that's all he was. He's just, yeah, he's my dead brother. You know, what does he do? He's dead. You know, what's his favourite hobby? He's dead. That's all he had. He's just the dead brother,
yeah,
in the story. And you were talking about narratives before. But when I actually looked into it and tried to remember properly, I remembered that we had proper rivalry. We were in competition with each other. Quite often we didn't like each other, mm, in the way that brothers, you know, there's a lot of kind of rough and tumble. But essentially we were the closest. We were closest in age. He was good at stuff, and therefore he's always catching me up. I quite get quite angry about that and want to, you know, grab my share of attention whenever I can. All that I'd forgotten. He was just the dead brother.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he's this real living being, you know, who I didn't always like very much, because he was the person who was going to take my share.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was really happy to recover that and realise, yeah, this is true, I thought. And in terms of memory, it's not often you can say, this is true. Yeah. And that's what you're looking for in a memoir. We talk about nonfiction and fiction, but that's the kind of core that you're looking for in the nonfiction. This is true, and I knew that was true, and I was really happy to rediscover it.
And also, I guess, like you said, to rediscover him, because I think that's, we've talked about it before, like, I think it's so important, like, to not put the dead on a pedestal after they're gone. You know, everyone, I had that bit of everyone's like, oh, you know, he was so one, he just loved your family. And I was like, yeah, but also other stuff. Like, I had a difficult relationship with my dad, and, you know, as much as I, you know, obviously loved him and was sad he was dead, there was, like, lots of other stuff. And whenever someone would make him this saint, it would make me feel so guilty about the other thoughts I had of, like, well, we kind of didn't, the last couple of weeks were quite tricky and I was rowing with him. And then you think, oh, my God, I'm a terrible person because the saint died and I wasn't very nice to them. Rather than the truth of, like, people are, like, and that's what I loved about the book as well. Like, Nikki, the way you talked about them was just like, yeah, like, you were an idiot, he was an idiot. Like, you just sounded like boys that fought and then got on and didn't get on. And like you said, it felt so much more real than the dead boy who isn't mentioned. And, yeah, it either becomes, like you said, the dead are either, like, sainted and angels, or they just don't exist.
Well, the letters of consolation here are part of that process. I don't know. Did you read all the letters of condolence?
No, I mean, I don't even know where they are.
Like, but they're very interesting. Yeah. I think they're an interesting thing to keep, and therefore to read later on, because not necessarily because, I mean, there will be interesting stories, as they were about Nikki. I mean, there are over 170, which, when I put the ones which were written to my parents together to the ones which were written to my grand, so there were, like, two sets, and because it was a letter writing age as well,
In
1978. And those have a lot of, he was the greatest boy who ever lived. And although there are interesting stories and you get some sense of some of the things that he did when people want to tell a memory and fix that in their own mind by writing it down, as much as anything, he came alive as a contrast to that. And I was looking at these things going, this can't be true. There were people writing things like, yeah, he's a fantastic conversationalist. He was nine. You know, I'm sure he could hold a conversation because he's a very bright boy. But it does kind of, I think they were as useful a resource as any. I had to try and recapture him later because I could sort of tell what was a little bit fake. And they're very hard things to write, letters
of condolence.
Condolence, like, which everybody knows.
Nobody wants to write, like, oh, we weren't getting on right. Which I get, but, like, that's important, I guess, to, you maybe not write that down, but you talk about that stuff. Because I think talking sometimes doesn't have the weight as well. So you can talk, hopefully, amongst the family and be like, oh, yeah, we do that a lot as a family. We'll remember, like, idiot stuff that my dad did. Like, God, do you remember when he did that? It was, like, utterly embarrassing. Do you remember the time he took us to someone's house, a business associate's house, and we were all there in America at this dinner, and then they left to go and get the dinner ready, and he turned around and said he didn't know who this family was. Like, he'd booked the wrong person. And it's like stories like that, we were like, they're so heartwarming when someone's gone, to remember, like, not like the bad things they did, just the human things, I guess. Yeah the human, like, that they, and you put some lovely stuff about Nikki, like the rows you had or the naughty things he did that make you feel like, especially, I guess, if you're talking in terms of character and writing and narrative, and you go, oh, I can really see that kid now. There's not a softness, but there's a softening in the pain when something is more real.
Yeah, I think that's right. And death can be very elevating in a not particularly helpful way.
Yeah,
As pedestals are raised and the dead are put on those
especially
pedestals.
With a child. I mean, God, of course.
Yeah, I think somewhere I put that death is character building. Because I was looking at this thing, and his character's amazing now that he's dead. So it's like an English education. We should all go through this because we become amazing.
Yeah, well, that's how I felt after my dad died. And they were just, the way they were talking about him, I was like, this guy sounds amazing. Who's this guy? Like, and as a kid, it's not, he was a really great person, but he was also really flawed, like as all great people are.
But that, I think, is one of the things which gets tangled up in the grief straight away, is this fear that, I mean, I'm talking now about people I've known who have died since I've been an adult, is that the reality will disappear, that the real person will get lost somehow in these mixture of, I mean, there are sometimes sentimental memories, there are exaggerated memories, And you don't want the real person to be lost. And that's what you have to try and hold on to. And that's why it's so useful. As you're saying, your family, you talk and you tell those stories. It kind of cements the real person. You don't want to cement the real person because that means they're fixed and you never get them out. But
it cements that moment, I think. And I find it really... And also with the family as well, people remember different stuff. So, you know, my mum will be like, no, that's not what happened. He said this. And me and my brother are like, oh, yeah. Like, and there's... It's such a joy to remember someone genuinely, you know, and I agree, the fakery doesn't feel like remembering them. It's performative.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this person's telling me my father was wonderful because they don't want to be rude. And I am agreeing because I don't want to be rude. And then that doesn't really involve my father at all. Like, that's me and that person having a strange conversation, very polite and no one's crying. But yeah, that's not him.
But it's like a kind of deal, I think, that sometimes... people make because death is so scary. The idea of not speaking ill of the dead, that's because you're in a way paying a tribute to death, and death will somehow spare you yourself from death, if not from the pain of death, if you're definitely just nice about dead people. And so it's all tangled up in the strange relationship that we have with death generally.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
In your 20s and later, did you go and seek help? Did you feel like, I have to go and talk to someone about this?
No, although not in my 20s or 30s. But eventually in my 40s, you know, you think you're going to run a 200-metre race, that is a 400-metre. Before you know it, you're doing half marathon. And before you get to the to looking for help, really, seeking help. But I didn't go to talk about Nikki and to talk about death. I went because I was worried about not feeling things very deeply. Mm. And although that hadn't particularly bothered me, the reason it hadn't bothered me until my 40s was because I'd been taught at a very early age that that's actually how you survive. That's how you get on and probably how you're successful. Mm. Don't feel things, just get on and do things. So, you know, don't feel, just act. But then it did start bothering me because the repression of grief is not a precision tool. You want to get rid of the grief, but you get rid of lots of other stuff as well. And if you can't feel grief, which is what you wanted as a positive outcome, I think you're going to find that you can't feel joy, you can't feel happiness, and you can't feel love, essentially. Mm. And that's something to regret when your own death comes into view, which I think when you get into your 40s is something that starts to happen. So then I did go to therapy, but I didn't know. That's what I wanted to talk about, really. I just want to talk about how to try and correct this.
Yeah.
Thinking, you know, couple of times should do it.
And then
within about, I was very lucky. I found someone who's very helpful straight away. And really, I think it must have been the second session. I just mentioned in passing, I had a dead brother. And you're like, trying to see his eyes go, ooh, we need to go have a talk about this.
Oh, that's why he's here.
But I hadn't even considered that might have it. We'd been in such denial about it, I didn't think this is something I need to go and talk about. And then suddenly, of course, I'm sitting in that context where you can say whatever you want. Because I just went with the mindset, I'm paying for this. I'm going to get my money's worth. I'm going to say whatever comes into my head. That's my only thing. Yeah, I'm not going to hold anything back because that's what I do outside that room. Yep. So here I'm just going to say whatever comes into my head. And then as soon as he, you know, I mentioned Nikki and Nikki dying, and I was 11 and he's 9. And then I just think, why? This is what I have to talk about. But I didn't go for that. And I didn't know that that's what the subject was, which I think is quite interesting. It's the grief will come back. You push it down, it will seep out the sides of however you're trying to tread on it. And it will come up, it will rise up, and it will manifest itself in your life in some way. And unless you realise that the cause is because you're stamping down on it and it's coming out the sides, then you're never going to get rid of that strange sensation of something bubbling up, which you don't really like.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I don't need to make you feel better, but like, I came from a family where it was talked about. I could talk about it. We cried in front of each other all the time. And then I didn't go to therapy till I was, sort of hit my 30s. And I had no idea that that was the problem. Equally, again, I was like, oh, I'm just really stressed. Just really stressed and not coping very well. That's what I get. I'm not coping with things. Like when things happen, I react quite strangely in a way that I see from people's faces is not what they expected me to react. And then I, again, was like, oh, you know, my dad died. But, you know, that really, there's much more other stuff that we could probably talk about. And now every week I'm like, it's probably about my dad, isn't it? Like, I'm just like, let's just cut to the chase. You know, I didn't get this thing and I'm upset about it, but it's probably because my dad died. And I wonder if that comes from being a child. Like, if, you know, it's just because it happened when you weren't a person yet. You were still forming yourself. And so it's still quite hard to pinpoint it, of like you said, of like, oh, what's that? Like, is that grief or is this because it happened when you weren't a fully you yet?
Yeah, I think one of the helpful things which I accept now and I think is true is that even with a major traumatic event when you're a child, that doesn't explain everything.
No, true.
And I really like the idea, or in the sense that I'm convinced by and persuaded by it, that whatever fault lines there are in a family or in the family dynamic, however the dynamic works, if there's a major traumatic event like a death of any family member, really, they will just exaggerate what is already there. And therefore it's not possible just to look at that one event and say, well, if that hadn't happened, we'd have been a happy family.
Oh, no.
There were already secrets. There were already things which weren't being expressed. And then that completely exaggerates that and just widens those fault lines which are already there. And I think that's quite useful to remember.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't blame everything on that. But I think until you've dealt with the earthquake, you can't almost work out what all the other problems are. Do you know what I mean?
Because it's very useful in showing you what you may not have noticed them because they might have been so small and they might have been just undercurrents in your family relationship. But obviously nothing remains an undercurrent from the point of view of a death, is that everything comes to the surface.
Yeah, and I think that's what's tricky. Like, me and my dad had not a great relationship anyway. And then he dies and it's like, well, that really fucked me off, to be honest, that he died. Because I was in the middle of a row. That's how I felt. It was like, well, what the fuck? Where's he gone? This is what we do. We like sort of spar and have a row and he's annoying. And it's like, so it was like definitely already a problem. But I suppose avoiding for years, like how I felt about how his death hadn't enabled me. Yeah, it enabled me to, I guess, because of the guilt. So it's like, once you deal with the thing and like, oh, well, I don't need to actually feel bad about how we got on. That's just how we got on. Then they can sort of start processing. But yeah, that's a very important thing to say, that it definitely isn't the be all and end all. It's the magnifying glass, I guess, or as you already eloquently said, the fault lines are already there. Did you have therapy before you wrote the book, or did it come afterwards? Because I thought even writing it must have been quite hard on you.
No, I started before I started writing the book.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear there was like support in writing it. Because you go back to Cornwall, but you go back to the beach, you walk down, like the description of like walking down and how hard it is to even get to this bloody beach. And I thought, God, it must have been obviously really important to go, but it must have been fucking hard.
Yes, but at the same time, there was a curiosity which needed to be sated. And because I had no memory of it, my subconscious was leading me through that whole trip, if you like, when I went back, is I didn't know where it was, and I thought, well, I'll just allow myself to recognize it, and I kept going wrong. I couldn't find it, because the subconscious really was telling you don't want to do this.
Yeah, that's
but my
amazing.
Biggest fear when I went back was I would find the place, I could stand on the same beach at the same level of tide, and I would feel nothing. That was actually the biggest fear I had. I was terrified of feeling something, but I was even more terrified of feeling nothing. And I didn't know what would happen, and that is quite a large part of the book, is that the emotional response I had to finding the place and my mind's eye, like recognizing it and trying to find exactly the same conditions of tide, and which became a bit of an obsession, really, so that I would get the most emotion out of it, because I did feel, and I felt very strongly, and my body physically reacted in ways that I hadn't predicted at all. But it shows how consuming grief is, because it was my body. My body was itself acting out a response to this grief. It had remembered. Whereas my conscious mind had gone off and done all these other things in my life and blacked this out, but my body didn't forget. And then it all came back when I was actually in the place, and the place became very important.
The bit you write about when you sort of get all the conditions right and you're there, I found really moving. And I think it's very hard for us as intellectual beings to get our heads around sometimes, because, like you said, your subconscious had done such a good job. Like, such an amazing job of, like, no, gone, protect it, that the body doesn't then filter down, and your body's like, okay, cool, sure, don't worry, I'll forget it as well. Like, it doesn't. And your description of it was really powerful. I just connected with it. I just really connected with standing at the edge of the world and feeling like, and just feeling the pain of all that sensation. And I imagine what you had was double that, because you were, you know, at the scene of his death. So I'm glad that you had some counselling too.
But I think there's a double grief which came out of this denial. So there's the grief for the death.
Yeah.
But then there was also a grief for not expressing grief at the time.
Yeah.
And that becomes quite complicated intellectually. And you can, I can anyway, because that's how my brain works. I could go and kind of explore that intellectually for some time and completely distract myself and not feel anything.
Yeah.
But actually it was very raw. But the rawness wasn't just grief at the fact that Nikki died. It was also this grief at this utter exclusion of grief at the time.
I felt
very sorry for all of us for not having been able to feel sorry at the time.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to allow that to come out as feeling. And it was very pure emotion that came out. And I was immensely relieved. And you were saying about tears being a medicine. That's how it felt. It felt like a very cleansing thing to go through. Sometimes I wish I could, well, I don't do it on a regular basis, because my temperament is to not want to go through these things on a regular basis.
But it was
in fact very, very, felt very cleansing. It felt like a great relief at the time.
Yeah. And there is that weird, not euphoria, but because you are lighter after you've done something like that, there are feelings of goodness after you've had that big cry. And it's almost like getting to it is so awful when you're having a bad day and, you know, grief is getting to you and you're fighting it so hard. And then the right thing that allows it to come out, that tap to be turned on, you know, afterwards you do feel like that moment when you're like, oh, okay, like, I'm glad that's out. I'm glad that's out of my body, because that's what it needs to be. It needs to be processed. But I think you just write so eloquently about, like you said, feeling sorry for all of you, because it's no one's fault that these things happen. They just happen. You said at the beginning, like, trying to get back to the boy before the event. Do you think you have by writing it? Do you think that, or do you think it's, you know, is irrevocably not, he didn't really exist in a way, or?
No, I think the one of the things which come out of the book is the danger of hoping that you'll be saved by epiphanies.
Especially if you're into narrative.
Yes, exactly. And fiction writers, we love our epiphanies.
Oh, I mean, everything is done.
Yeah, and there'll be one moment where everything becomes clear.
Perfect.
And then everyone gets married at the end and then everyone's happy. And the epiphany of finding the day that went missing.
Yeah.
It was fantastic to get as much of it together as I could. And the day is no longer missing. Or not all of it. Some bits of every day will be missing.
Yeah.
But it has been recovered. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that my habits of repression, our family habits of repression, have completely disappeared overnight. We went out for lunch on my brother and I and my mum on the anniversary of Nikki's birthday this year, which was in March. And we sat down, we're having a nice Sunday lunch, roast dinner, but we didn't actually talk about him until we got to about coffee and, and then we got round to it. But it's something.
Huge.
It's better. But it wasn't like we sat down and it was all, we were telling stories like you were saying about your dad. And it took a while to get there because you have these habits that it's very hard to break. It's a kind of slow process. And I think it requires attention. It requires a kind of conscious decision to keep Nikki in mind. Sometimes I can still forget, you know, his birthday, the actual day of his birthday can go past and I go, oh, that's I just missed it again. There isn't a kind of catharsis where everything has changed, now everything is better, but it's made me very aware of a habit of repression which just needs to be policed by myself. Not in a kind of brutal way. My inner policing here isn't
gentle policing.
Yes, exactly. They're not coming in a big van with bars over the windows. It's just community policing. I'm doing community policing of my own remembering of Nikki.
Do you feel you have the like Nikki's flame slightly? Like, do you feel like it's your job to kind of keep him?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I'd be interested to know what you think about this as well. Because, you know, I wrote the book. Mm. I was closest to him in age. I wrote the book. And therefore, I think it's really dangerous to start thinking, well, Nikki's now mine. He's my territory. I did Nikki. You know, I wrote this book. And therefore, I'm the Nikki expert in our family. You know, for all your Nikki needs, come to me. That's not really fair. Everybody's got their memories. My brothers aren't writers, but they've got their memories. They've got that absolute equal right to Nikki and their memories of him and his role in their life. And my mum especially.
Of course,
I feel sometimes there is a slight territorial tussle between us. So since I've written the book, she'll remember something. And sometimes things which I wish she'd remembered before because they're beautiful and poetic.
Yeah.
She told me, this is after the book's written, so it's not in the book, that I can't remember the period of time, but it was for a period of time after Nikki died that her arms would ache. So we talked about that, and we think it was probably because either in her sleep or somehow unconsciously she was trying to hug
him
and her arms were aching. And it was something that she remembered after the death of her child. I found that incredibly moving.
Yeah.
But she will remember things like this occasionally. And I think it is... it's partly because we're thinking about Nikki now and therefore the memories are coming back. But there's also a slight territorial thing here that mum says, well, that was mine and you didn't get that. but as long as we're aware of this.
Didn't make the book, did it?
Exactly, you don't know everything.
Of course, she's his mum.
Yeah, and as long as we're aware of that, that's fine. And in a way, I can't enter her grief. You can't enter other people's grief, which is one of the reasons why it's devastating, is because you're very alone, but you don't have to be completely alone, but there will always be a bit that nobody else can touch.
God, yeah. And that is what a your mum, that is a really beautiful thing to say. Like, both of us are welling up at that, because that is really sad. And in a way it's nice, I guess, that it wasn't in the book, because it's like have that is so personal. Yeah, I think I definitely, the reason I'm interested is because, I equally am the one who does the podcast, the one who does writes about him. And I definitely don't feel like the expert, definitely not, because my brother is older. So there's a whole, which I'm now really understanding. Now I've had a child, like, he's 4 years older, which when I was a kid, I was like, so what? What's 4 years? Big deal. And now you're like, 4 years is massive. So much can happen. And so I don't feel like the expert on him at all. But I suppose I feel like it's more about my grief, and it's more about like my continuing the conversation. And I don't feel like it's too much about them. It feels like this is my story and my grief, and that I didn't get to finish the conversation. So I'm sort of carrying it on with him in the background. But I don't feel like my mum and my brother have that need in the same way that I do, because of the different relationships and different dynamics. And, you know, they were older when it happened, and they went to counselling as well at different times. And I really didn't. I really sort of didn't know how to talk about it. So now I feel like once I opened the door, I was like, I'm not closing. I know that feeling of being the only one sort of discussing it and investigating it. But it's not to say they're not. They're just not doing it in the way that we are in a sort of public forum.
Well, that's question of letting everyone grieve in their own way.
Exactly.
Even if you don't always understand how that is, but it would be very odd for you to say to your brother, well, you should do a grief cast. That would really help.
I know. Actually, someone tweeted me and was like, you should get your mum and your brother on the show. And I was like, they don't want to. I mean, my mum definitely didn't want to. My brother listens, let me know. You'll be welcome. God, that would be hilarious. Because it would just be arguments over memories.
I can see in your face. You just imagine that. You thought, I just really don't want to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. Because you get these arguments about memories, you know? Like, there's a lot of, like, that's not what... And me and my brother can argue. But, I think that's really important that they've let me grieve like this. Like, I think that's quite nice as well. Like, they don't mind me doing the show. And I equally don't feel compelled to have them on the show. And... don't mind that they don't talk about it. And funny enough, dates is a big thing because I remember the date. My dad's anniversary is like burned into my brain, but my brother forgets it, absolutely forgets it. And for years, we've always been a bit like, I have to sort of remind him. And he was listening to the show and he said, that other guest said they forget the date. So it's not just me. And I was like, yeah, it's not. It's just however you process it. You know, it's very, very personal. Do you think you're right about it again? Or do you feel like you've kind of... done, or that's a strange question, but not done.
Well, it felt like it was a kind of comprehensive investigation into that. You know, the event of my brother's death. I think I can't help but write about it in terms of this mystery I was talking about of fiction. You know, where does fiction come from? I think it will continue to come out. I mean, one of the things that I noticed when I started writing the non-fiction book about Nikki and about I was trying to recover my dad's role in it all. And then I looked through my novels and every one of my novels had a bad dad. You know, the dads are drunks, they fall off ladders, they're kind of demanding, they're going to neglect their children, they get arrested for selling, you know, cigarettes to underage people. That happened in one of the books. I mean, they're just, all the dads, they were just bad dads. I had a succession of bad dads. And that was to do with Nikki's death. And that was to do with my own sense of, well, why didn't he save Nikki? That's what dads are for. So that's one way in which it would come out in the fiction. And in this novel I'm writing, I'm sure there are aspects of Nikki's death which come out. But certainly I don't feel I'm going towards something in anymore. And it's almost as if having written that book and discovered, I think, the source for a lot of the material that I was fictionalizing before, it's almost like I'm now writing my first proper novel. For my 11th book will be my first proper novel. All the other ones were like feints towards this one subject. But now I feel I can open up to other subjects. So I don't think I'll be writing about it directly, but I think it will always be there in some way.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Like you sort of have to process and deal with these things. Otherwise it comes out in these myriad of ways, sometimes great in fiction and sometimes bad in emotions. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I feel like that as well. If I was to do another podcast, it probably wouldn't be death related. I've definitely dealt with a lot of this. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me in.
No, it's a pleasure to talk about Nikki and your brilliant book, The Day That Went Missing. You can follow Richard on Twitter at BeardRichard, that's B-E-A-R-D, and then Richard. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.